For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Okay, let's get started. Session number three. Let me just start with a quasi-love and logic moment, although it's not really love and logic, it's just common sense. But just taking a quick poll, what time did you think we were going to get started tonight? 8:10?
8:10.
Like, what time did you think I was actually going to start? Like, if you planned yourself, when do I need to get here because I'm going
to
start?
5 minutes to
8:05? Why did you? And why did you think 8:10? Right. So this is a very important, instructive moment. I feel like I'm standing with an echo here, so I'm going to move forward a little bit. 8:10 is about right, and the reason for that is because that's when we started last week, and the week before that was also about 8:07, 8:10. And so what most normal human beings do is, without being malicious or conniving, they say, well, we started at about 8:05, 8:07 for the last 2 weeks, so we'll probably start around then the third week. So I don't need to get there at 5 to 8 because we're not starting anyway till 8:07. Now, is that like mean or malicious on any of your parts? No. Do I hold it against you? No. Why did you do that? It's my fault. I mean, seriously, I created an expectation that when I say the class starts at 8, I'm not really starting till somewhere between 8:07 or 8:10, at which point most of you, without even consciously planning it, maybe it was a little bit conscious, but certainly it was subconscious, I don't need to be there till this time. That is a very important reality. That is classic. Again, I love and logic is just using a catchphrase, so you put it like it's a behavior modification approach. If I act towards you this way, you're going to respond the way. Guess who we do that with all the time? That's right, you're in a parenting class. So with our children, if we say certain things and act on them in a certain way, like bath time is in 5 minutes, and then we give them a bath 20 minutes later, and then the next night we say bath time is in 5 minutes, and we give them a bath 20 minutes later, and then the third night you say bath time is in 5 minutes, and 6 minutes later I don't understand. Why don't they listen? So I'll tell you what, they are listening. They're listening very well to what your 5 minutes mean 20 minutes. And they're very consistent, just like you're consistent. And it's something to pay attention to, that in the same way we respond this way to almost every class you go to, whatever level, anything you're participating in, you just know how the system works, and you respond to that. So our children are always paying attention to whether or not we mean what we say. And if we mean what we say, they get it. And if we don't, they get that too, and we've taught them to behave. What I hope to accomplish tonight, is to go through some of these things in the sheets. I want to go through a couple of ideas on the concept of parenting, just very briefly in the beginning. I want to then go through a bunch of practical examples, because that's how I learn, and so I like to teach in the way that I learn. So we spent the last 2 weeks going through two different theories, whether or not it's Faber and Maslisch, which is a lot more about feelings and how to talk and how to listen, or love and logic, which is much more behavioral. I want to spend that, let's just do it. Let's give lots of examples and see what it sounds like, what it feels like to actually go through this. I think you'll find it beneficial, I hope so. And then we'll touch a little bit about siblings, which may or may not be relevant to you yet, but it will be soon enough. And if it's not relevant to you, it'll apply to friends. Same way that you address most sibling issues will apply to how you address friends' issues. And then hopefully, if there's time, I'm happy to stay for some questions, any specific examples that you guys might have. If you look at letter A, one of my favorite questions, think about how you would answer this question. Is your child clay, analogous to clay in the hands of a sculptor, or a seed in the hand of a gardener? How would you view conceptually? Here we have this unbelievable gift. A child has been given to us. We are in charge of raising this child. It's a massive responsibility if we ever would stop to think about it, which thankfully we don't, because we would be so overwhelmed if we actually thought about the level and magnitude of the responsibility. Which way should we view it? Do we have clay? And it's our responsibility to shape and mold the clay? Or do we have a seed and it's our responsibility, like a gardener, to provide an environment that would allow the seed to grow. How would you answer that?
I picked the latter.
The seed.
Yeah.
Agree? Disagree?
I think a little bit of both.
A little bit of both? Okay, which aspect? This is an important just concept. Does anybody think it's purely like clay and molding it? Does that strike you as the mold or method of parenting? Yes?
Today, I said to my daughter, Mara, she's mine to ruin.
Yeah. We can talk more about that later. Okay, what strikes us as odd about the clay and the sculptor model?
The sculptor has an idea in mind of what he wants his kid or what he wants the thing to be, and the kid may not want to be what his father thinks or what his mother thinks.
Excellent. Everybody agree to that? In this room, that looks making a lot of sense, right? And we go, yeah, of course. You can't take a piece of clay and mold it to what you want. That's clay, but this is my child. Did any of us turn out the way that our parents wanted us to turn out? I was just, maybe some of you did. I didn't. My siblings didn't. Our parents have a certain, this is what we would have wanted, and we came out the way we wanted, which is probably the way that most children eventually grow up. So it's just a conceptually very important thing to remember and recognize as we go through this experience, we're actually not molding clay, because they have their own personalities, they have their own gifts, their own challenges, their own stresses, different than ours, and as much as we want to force and shape, particularly as we're like raising these little, we want them to be what we want them to be. It's actually much more like a seed. Now, what does the significant? Well, there's a little bit of both, but it's much more like a seed, which means I have a seed, and what do I need to provide to allow this seed to be its best that it can be? It needs to be nurtured. It needs an environment. It needs sunlight, food, all of the things that a seed would need in order to be able to become really what it can become. Part of which is weeding. That's where that element comes in. If it's growing wild, it does need to be trimmed back sometimes. It needs to be shaped. Sometimes a tomato plant needs to be helped standing up straight. So there is elements of shaping and forming, but the model is much more one of a seed. Yeah?
I like that, but instead of seed and program, to be a certain.
Correct. Right? And let me pick up on that. The trick in parenting is, if I know I have a tomato seed for a tomato plant, then I know what it needs. It needs a certain type of environment, a certain amount of water and sunlight. And if I have a cucumber, or if I have an apple seed, then I know what I need to do in order to have it flourish. Problem with parenting is there's no like package that the child comes in that says, I'm an apple seed. This is the type of earth I need. This is the amount of sunlight, or shade, or water, or temperature. I have no idea. And guess what? Some of us have multiple children in the house who are different packages, which means that we need to figure out, in order to allow each seed to grow and flourish, what kind of approach, how much sunlight, how much nurturance, standoff, tough love, warm love, all the different things that are out there. But it's a model of, I can't shape and form, I can't break, my child is who my child is, and I need to allow it to develop, to be the most beautiful, fully developed, flourishing flower that it can, knowing that I might really want apple trees. And if I can't have an apple tree, at least an orange tree. And you know what? You got a cucumber. And you had these plans for this huge tree that was going to be magnificent and give shade and fruit forever. And you have a cucumber. That's what you got. And it can be a magnificent cucumber as long as you recognize that that's the seed that I have and it's going to be beautiful and delicious and productive as a cucumber. Even though I really want an apple tree. And it's very hard. It's you can shape and push, force and model, but it's just what it is. And it's just an important thing. I just like to mention this as we get into anything in parenting, to keep that in mind. It's something that we all need reminders of all of the time. And I just start with that. Let me add one other point before we get back into our hands-on working on through a bunch of different cases. And that is something from a book from a Rebbe of mine from Baltimore, Moshe Eisman. Rabbi Moshe Eisman wrote a book called The Parents and Penguins, also highly recommended. It's a quick read. He writes in here, and this is, I add this because this is his title, of Parents and Penguins. There is a Gemara, a piece of the Talmud that teaches that even had the Torah never been given, we would have learned various principles in life from the animal kingdom. We would have learned propriety from the cat. We would have learned self-sufficiency from the ant. We would have learned chastity from the dove, decency from the hen. And the Talmud gives a list of traits that we would have learned from the animal. Even if the Torah wouldn't have told us that we need to act in this way or that way, we would have looked at the animal world around us and seen this is appropriate behavior. And Rav Eisen points out that there's something missing from the list. It does not say in the Talmud that we would have learned parenting techniques from the animal kingdom. She writes as odd, because if you look in the animal kingdom, you will find altruism, you will find self-sacrifice, you will find elements of what would seem to be tremendous parenting skills, like the emperor penguin, for example, which is where he brings the title of his book. When it's time to mate, the male and the female travel over 130 kilometers from the sea, which might take a month of travel, until which they mate, the female lays the egg, the male stays with the egg for 2 months' time in the freezing cold with nothing to eat, while the female goes back to the sea and gorges herself, comes back to feed the young. And this male just sits there with the infant penguin after it hatches, and the egg until it hatches, for 2 months, just waiting. Couldn't we learn something from that? Couldn't we learn something from the wasp, which prepares its nest, lays its egg, and then flies away, never to even see the self-sacrifice of how it's willing to provide for its future, and not even be able to reap the benefits of seeing the nachas of a little child dressed for Shabbat? Nothing. Doesn't get that. We could learn, but the Gemara doesn't say that. You know why, suggests Rav Eisen. And I find this a beautiful thing, and I share this with you, because the animal kingdom, when it parents because it's an innate, inborn trait that it has. The perpetuation of the species. Just continue. Reproduce. Give on to the next generation. And I did my part. The species continues and nature smiles. Human beings, the Torah that we were given, the Jewish life that we have, says you, I, we as parents are part of the equation. It's not about just making sure there's another generation, which is true, but that we grow in the process. We live, change, develop. Anyone here ever struggle in our parenting? Why are we here? Because it's hard work. And guess who grows in the process? We do. And part of parenting is learning the patience, the skills, how to react, how to apologize when I mess up as a parent to my child. It's not easy to apologize to a child. It's not easy to say, you know, I lost my cool and I yelled at you and I was wrong and I'm sorry. That's not easy to do to a 7-year-old or a 10-year-old or a 15-year-old. And there's human growth. And we don't learn from the animal kingdom. Doesn't have anything to teach us about parenting because we're part of the equation. And I stress this as I always back to the Marvin story. And Marvin in the supermarket is learning patience. And we're all Marvin as we push our cart through the supermarket, remembering, don't lose your cool. Stay calm. You're in charge. You're responsible. And dealing with all of the affronts that we have from our children, all those things, we're part of the equation. And never to forget, as we're busy trying to figure out the type of seed that we have and shape and model and allow it to grow, I shouldn't use the word shape and model, we provide the environment that allows the seed to grow and flourish, that we're part of the equation. And you should, and I think about this all the time personally and share with you, I actively think about that, like, this is part of my challenge in life. It's not just my child's challenge. This is my challenge. I have a child that provides me with this challenge, and part of my human experience after 120 years, when I stand before the heavenly court, I will be judged on, how did you handle that situation as a parent? How did you grow from that situation? How did you do with that time that way? You messed up there, but did you learn from it the next time? And we're part of the equation. And it's just, I always find critical to remember as we go through it, that that is a element of the experience. And I'll leave you with those two thoughts as we begin our final session. Okay, any thoughts or from this past week? Anyone work on anything that we've been discussing? Any successes, failures, anything that anybody just wants to share? Just like to give anyone an opportunity. Everybody was perfect. Your children were perfect. It was amazing. Fabulous. I don't believe any of you. It's fine. Totally fine. Okay, we'll move on. As I said, these are tools, techniques, and you might have been doing exactly what I said, fine, and maybe someone else disagreed, or maybe it was too much. What I want to do tonight is really go through a bunch of things. That's just how I would handle it. And again, this is just Me, as a person, as I've mentioned many times, a love and logic trained believer in the theory will look at me and say that I'm a sellout. I don't really believe in it, and I don't. I'm telling you, it's a great tool, and if you like it, buy the book, listen to the recordings, and do it more than I do. I find it to be a fabulous tool that tells me I know how I'm going to handle every situation. Will it result in my child doing what I want? No, not always. Will they learn the lessons of responsibility? I don't know. Maybe yes, maybe no. But do I, as a parent, know this is how I'm going to approach it, and if it works, great, and if it doesn't, I still know what I'm doing as a tool. Fabulous. I love it. It gives me a lot of confidence in approaching situations, which we'll go through. If you come to my house, would you see my little children following around me obediently doing everything? No, you wouldn't. You really wouldn't. Even tonight, two of my kids ended up in bed without a bath because they wouldn't come when they wanted to, and they weren't happy about it. And you think, haven't they been experienced? Don't they know that if they don't listen, they're going to suffer the consequence? Yeah, they're kids. They're 2 and they're 5, and they do what they want when they want. But I knew just this is what I was going to do when they refused to get into the bath. And I asked them 6 times already, and I was done. So I said, that's it. And I just picked them up and carried them into the room. Like, for example, just again, tonight, like, calling the 2 and the 5 year old, like, 4 or 5 times, we're done. So I go to the 2 year old and I pick him up, because I can still do that to a 2 year old, and he starts screaming, I don't want to take a bath! I say, we're not taking a bath. He says, not? I said, no, we're getting straight into pajamas. And he goes, okay. So he thinks he wins. Except the thing is that when he gets into pajamas, the thing about it, he goes straight into his crib when he's finished with his pajamas and there's no more playing. So he throws a fit, but he can't get out of his crib yet. So it's just a matter of, well, I'm so sorry, we weren't able to take a bath. And I always use a line of, if you're too tired to be able to come, take a bath when it's time, then I just assume you're just ready for bed. And that was the end of it. He just, cried for 3 minutes, and then he decided he was ready to be covered with his blanket, and I did, and he went to sleep. But was that the way that I wanted the evening to go? No, not quite. But I just, like, what am I going to do when I call them 6 times and they don't come? I'm not running after them. That's not going to happen. So, and I'm not going to pick him up and put him in the bath because that's going to be a disaster. But I can put him in his crib. So, now it didn't work for my 5-year-old. It's a little different, but it's an approach as to what I'm going to do. Let's go through a bunch of examples. Let's just go through this. Now, the key thing is owning the problem, as I said, and empathy. Empathy is really hard. But empathy is all about being on their side. Really feeling bad that they don't get what they wanted, and you want to be on their side. I really wish you could, and then explaining why it is that they can't. If you don't have empathy, this won't work. And I've experienced that many times. You're just angry, you're resentful, and you feel like you're getting back at them. It doesn't work. You really have to be on their side. And we'll go through in a bunch of ways how that applies. I just want to just stress that over. If you ever find yourself administering a consequence, and you're feeling like vengeful, like like just pull back a second and say, okay, calm down, I'm not doing this right. Just, you have to really want to be on their side. So your husband told me that there was an issue with the kids figuring out a video, and he said, I want you guys to be able to watch a video, but if you can't figure out amongst yourselves, like, what do you want me to do? I want you to. And it just changed the whole dynamic of, it's not me against them. I'm with you. I want this to work out. When you guys are ready to help, we'll be able to do so. Okay, key phrases. Let's go through a bunch of issues with owning the problem becomes their problem, you're on their side, and they need to figure it out. Okay. Let's go to I'm going to go to the second one first. You have a child who speaks to you without respect. It could be in a number of different ways. From a 2-year-old saying, I want soda. Or it sounds like, give me a cup, pour me a cup, or any number of ways in which a 2-year-old, 3-year-old, 4-year-old, 5-year-old speaks to you in a way in which you don't necessarily think is appropriate. So the last thing in the world that you should do is whatever it is that they ask for. Now, I have seen this in which very well-meaning parents, after their child, say 4-year-old at the table, says, pour me soda. And the parent takes the cup, and very calmly, while they're pouring the soda, says, now, sweetheart, that's really not the way to ask, okay? Next time, please ask me nicely. What's the likelihood that the next time the child will ask nicely? And the child doesn't even hear those words. I mean, the child demanded something, and the parent did it. You can say, ah, bah, 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 the child's hearing, ah, bah, 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 bah. All I know is that they demanded it, and they got it. So why would they not do it the next time? So it's just, watch yourselves how many times you do something like that. Right away, a child speaks inappropriately, there needs to be a response of, well, I'm not doing anything about this. Two phrases to use that if you're in my house for any period of time, you'll hear all the time. Number one, which is a much lighter form of a response, and then if you feel he needs to be more serious. The lighter one sounds like, well, that's a funny way to ask. Very simple phrase. That's a funny way to ask. I don't see anything else. That's it. Now, eventually the children will learn, that didn't work. Let me try something else. They'll be pretty quick to figure out if they make a demand of, poor me. And you say, whoa, that's a funny way to ask. They'll say, please, can you pour me? Great. Sure, I'd love to, sweetheart. Simple again. My goal here is, like what I started from, we want to have an environment of the home that is pleasant and that the exchanges between parent and child work, that we're not stressed. So we simply know and have simple, simple tools how to respond. You get any request from a child that you don't feel is appropriate, that's a funny way to ask, over and over again. If you feel it's a child's getting older and it's filled with chutzpah and it's a little more than a 4 or 5 year old who's just saying, or you could have a 2 year old who's filled with chutzpah also if they're precocious, as many of our children. Anyway, I respond when I'm spoken to nicely. That's a harsher way to respond. Like, I'll answer you when you talk to me nicely. It's the same thing. It's an I statement. It's not a, you won't talk to me that way. But it's a matter of that has a little bit more bite to it, and you'll, again, if you'd be in my house, you would see with some of the older children where it's already, you know how to, I'm not training a 4 year old how to speak. That was inappropriate. They'll be like, that was inappropriate. I'll respond to you when you talk to me nicely. Yeah.
Is it down to these two ways to respond, or is it any number?
Anything that you've, something along those lines. The main thing is that you get into a habit of when a request is made that's inappropriate, there is no move to respond to the request in any way other than you'll change the way you speak without saying something along the lines of, you don't talk to me that way, young man, because how would we expect a child to respond to that? Like, oh yes, I will. Or if they give in that time, but it's a very negative interaction as opposed to a very, and I like keeping it light as best as possible. Like, oh, that's a funny way to ask. That's literally our catchphrase in our house. I welcome you to borrow it. If you have something that you're more comfortable with, go right ahead.
Can you respond with a question like, can you ask me nicely?
Yeah, sometimes we'll say, maybe you want to try asking me. And is there any variation of, you want to try asking me again? Whatever works for you, your personalities, in your home, whatever you want. But it's a response of, I'm not going to do anything until you change the way you speak. Without saying to them, change the way you speak. Because when there's that command, this is the more favorite match. Like, how do you speak that a child hears you? And just, yeah.
So it has to be a verbal thing?
That's fine. 100%. If you like just a nonverbal, totally fine. Whatever it is, I'm just stressing that there's a beginning of, there is no response of, here, let me pour you and tell you that you need to change your behavior. That doesn't work. Comments, questions, make sense? This hopefully should be logical where I'm sharing you my experience in life, and it could be you're all ahead of me. I didn't think of these things on my own. When I heard them, I said, that makes a lot of sense. Tried them, and they work, but I needed to hear them from someone else. So I'm just sharing what I've picked up over the years. I hope you're saying, well, that's obvious. If you're doing it already, great. I wasn't, and I heard it, and I was like, yeah, that totally changed the whole dynamic of my house. Questions? Yeah.
What do you do when they say you're me?
So that's right into a favorite message. I'm so sorry you feel that way. You know mommy loves you. That would be the kind of response in that first class of I hate Bubby. So instead of saying, you don't hate your grandmother, Sheila. So you say, I'm so sorry. Or you could say, I know you think that I'm being mean. I see that you feel like I'm being mean, but I just want you to know that I love you. So just acknowledge what they're saying. And you could say, but I love you. So that you're not saying, I'm not mean. Because right now the child is actually experiencing you as being mean. Which, from the child's experience, you are. Because they want ice cream and you're saying, no. Or they want to play and you're saying it's time to go to bed. So you are mean. Now, you have their best interest in mind, but you are being mean to them, and they also know that they're hopefully trying to push some buttons. So they're good like that. So be like, I know I'm so sorry that you feel like I'm being mean to you, but I just want you to know that I love you. That's the way I would respond to that. Which really brings me to the next one, because I love you so much. This is a tool which the Love and Logic Techniques calls, is my version of what they call going brain dead. Going brain dead in Love and Logic terminology is when a child asks you a question in which you've either answered already or you are not interested in engaging with your child for lots of reasons. They ask you, whatever their question is, there's not an answer that you can give them, either because they're not old enough to understand or you just don't want to engage it with them for a thousand reasons. Can I sleep in your bed tonight? And the answer is no. Maybe it's because you need to be doing work in there and you need the lights on, or because you've just had enough of the kids sleeping in your bed at night, whatever it may be. And so the answer is, so you can either just say no, or we try to avoid the word no, we say maybe another night. And they say, why can't I? Fair question from a child? Fair question. How do you answer that question? Like, I'm a parent. I got to get a couple kids to bed, and I have a child who wants to sleep in my room, and for whatever reason, they can't tonight. And now they say, why can't I? Any suggestions? Okay. But how about if you, after I go sleep, you move me? I mean, if you, the problem here is if you engage, there really is no satisfactory answer to a child. From my perspective, I'm the 4-year-old, there is nothing you can say that I will respond to with, oh, I'm sorry. I'll ask again tomorrow night. Thanks, I got it. There's nothing you can say. Nothing. And whether or not they're asking for ice cream at 5 o'clock and you say, well, we're about to eat dinner, I'll eat dinner after the ice cream. So you can get into a battle in which you say, no, you won't. Yes, I will. No, you won't. Yes, I will. We did this last night and you didn't. Tonight we'll be there. It's just like, it's just the whole conversation is you lost. If you engage in the conversation, you have lost because there's no dialogue here. This will apply in many, 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 many questions your children ask in which there just isn't an answer that they're happy with. So how do you deal with that? So in Love and Logic terminology, this is that you go brain dead. Now, the way that they have a different way of responding, the way that I like to respond to it is with the phrase of, because I love you so much. So the conversation goes something like this. Can I sleep in your bed tonight? No, I'm sorry, not tonight. Why not? Because I love you so much. But so then can I sleep in your bed tonight? No, not tonight. I told you already. Why not? Because I love you so much. And it goes around, but I'm not engaging because I don't have an answer. But what I want them to hear is that I love them so much. And then, if you love me so much, then why can't I sleep there? Because I love you so much. Now, what I'm doing is, in using love and logic, now I'm going brain dead, meaning I'm just repeating the same thing over and again as if I have no train of thought and nothing to say, because there is nothing to say. There is no end to this dialogue. It doesn't have an end. Children are entitled to ask for what they want. We as parents are entitled to say it's not happening. They are then entitled to want an explanation, which we don't have. I mean, we can explain to a child. You can't. So you give an answer, which is not giving an answer, and you just go into, I will say that 10 times. At this point, it's a running joke in my family. They know already. When that happens, the conversation is over. They're not going to get anywhere because they can ask as much as they want, and the answer is always going to be, because I love you so much, and the answer is no. It's not happening. Why? Why? Because I love you. That's why. But it doesn't make any sense. I know, but I love you so much. Now, and you can laugh all you want. Try it. What it does is, again, the point here is there's a conversation which has no end. There's a question that they want an answer for which they are not either entitled to, capable of understanding, or will like. So you just, I don't engage. I don't engage the dialogue, and I just have the same phrase I repeat over and over. You don't have to use because I love you so much. You could just say, Love and Logic uses the phrase, I love you too much to argue. I mean, you're trying to engage in an argument or a debate. So their language they use is, I love you too much to argue with you, or I love you too much to debate. I didn't like that, so I just left it as, just because I love you so much. And they don't understand, and now it's a running joke, but it ends every conversation of, don't even bother because there's no answer coming. Yeah?
I hope they'll just stop engaging.
They will. In other words, that goes back to the, you know, like if I told you in the slot machine example we brought last week, if you were about to play the slot machine and I told you, I just want you to know, this slot machine's broken. Nobody ever wins. So how many times will you... So you're going to test me? Like, really? Maybe you want to play. So you don't want me to play this. So you'll test it a couple times. And then you'll say, well, he's probably right. No one's ever going to win. And you don't bother anymore. So that line is, end the conversation. I'll repeat it 100 times. That's why I take that phrase. Because I like saying that phrase 100 times. And you could say it in a funny way, you could be cute, you could, but don't engage the dialogue when it has no end. Yeah?
Do you use this method to fend off the members who...
Yeah, sometimes. There it sounds more like, I'll get back to you. That's a great question. I'll get back to you on that one.
I guess this would work with friends, employees, things like that. I mean, would it work with...
Obviously with a different phrase. In other words, yes. In other words, what you're pointing out is sometimes somebody asks you a question, and for whatever reason, you don't have an answer to give them. Either because they're not allowed to have the information, or you don't have the information, or they won't understand, whatever. So I can't engage a dialogue trying to answer something that I don't have an answer to. It goes nowhere. So with children, they're always asking, and they're entitled to ask. But when you get that sense of, I'm not going to explain it to you. So instead of saying something along the lines of, you'll understand when you're older. Right? That's a favorite. Children, we love, okay. I'll remember to ask you again in a few years when I'm like, that doesn't work. But not answering. So you just say like, the reason is because I love you. But it's just a great little tool technique to somehow deal with it. Yeah.
She says, we don't have
hardware support. I imagine you just hang up. Now, the thing with the telemarketer is you also have the option of just hanging up on them without going through that. You don't really have that option with your children. So that's why this kind of phrase, try it, see if it works. You'll see that eventually they'll give up, and then you end up with just this, what becomes a real pleasant exchange of, because they'll get frustrated, but like not terribly frustrated. And the answer, reality is, I don't have a better answer to say. Yeah, whatever. Sometimes, yeah, again, everything is different. In my house, we depending on who's going to bed when, sometimes I have two rooms with two kids in them, and sometimes they need to be separated. So if I know that I need my room available because that bedroom has to be split up, then I can't split up that bedroom because then I end up with third. So there are, you know, all sorts of calculations. Putting children to bed is very, very complicated. As you all know. Okay, let's move on. We have a lot of cover. Now, the other great phrase in letter D, great phrase is, you don't have to eat it. Now, when does this apply? This applies when a child says, can I have some orange juice? And they ask very nicely. They say, sure. And you pour them what you think is an appropriate amount of orange juice for a 2, 3, 4, 5-year-old child. And they say, right. Your response is, what are some options? Right? That, which is a fine response. If you finish that, I'll give you more, which is fine. That works. I do that a lot also, which is a great response. If you finish that, I'll be happy to give you more. Another great response is, you don't have to eat it. And I take the cup back. And then they say, which is great. Conversation over. We avoided what would have otherwise been a catastrophe of a back and forth. It is enough. It's not enough. Say, the phrase, you don't have to eat it. I use that, you'll see how many times that comes up of all the time of, you don't have to eat it. Nobody has to eat anything in this house. I'm not going to force you. You don't have to eat it. Now, if it's something that they do need to eat in order to get what they really want, so then it's a matter, and then it's the same story of, and we're going to get to one of the examples back in, I want cake. You're welcome to have cake when you finish dinner. I don't like dinner. You don't have to eat it. End of the conversation. You don't have to. You don't have to eat it. But I want my cake. Well, then you can give them different choices, but it's just a great phrase to have it on the tip of your tongue, and it's fine. You don't have to eat it. Just give a couple phrases. Good to have. Put in your back pocket. Use them as much as you want. Question? Does somebody have a question? Comment?
I just hope that you're going to get to that whole, like,
we're getting there. Yeah, we're getting there. A little bit. I hope we get there. For older phrase, let me go to the letter A, which I skipped. These are really for older kids, which is about them owning the problem. When something happens, having the phrase of, wow, what do you think we should do about that? Which is a great phrase, even for little younger kids, that suddenly they're looking to you to solve their problem. You're the parent. They did something, let's say, wrong or inappropriate or something happened, and they want you to fix it. It could be as simple as they spilled orange juice all over the kitchen floor. As a parent, the response is, here it is on the floor, big mess. Whoa, wow, what do you think we should do about that? And then go back to whatever you're doing. Now you laugh, right? What are they? What's the, now? What they're hoping that you're going to clean up their mess. I don't want to clean up my child's mess. My child needs to clean up my child's mess. But they're looking to me to do it, and I just like, whoa. Now, here this really takes a lot of practice, and I see that you're laughing because you're not really used to doing this way. Normally, what happens is something along the lines of, what? I can't believe you spilled again. And then as you're like grabbing the towel, how many times do I have to? Try something else. Like, big mess. Stay calm. Wow, look at all that orange juice on the floor. What do you think we should do about that? And you go back to what you're doing. Yeah. Yes, we have to go through that stage of stuff. Like, no, that is not your job at all. Now, what's most likely going to happen in most homes when you say something to a 3 or 4 year old along the lines of, wow, ice cream on the floor, what should we do about that? They're going to say something along the lines of, exactly, right? A good child will say, well, you should clean it up and give me more ice cream. Right? Most child, that's what they should say. And your response to that is?
If you want
dessert,
you'll clean it up.
Right? Something along the lines of, well, you know, totally fine. The towel, and I wouldn't even say you clean it up. The response would be, this would be, now shifting to Faber-Maslisch language, the paper towels are over there. Anything else? They'll eventually come up with that idea, but it's your, I'm handing the problem to the child. What do you think we should do about that? And you could suggest there are towels in the drawer over there. And now they run off to the playroom. Right? You Faber-Maslisch them with the language. I didn't direct them. I didn't instruct. I just said, wow, orange juice on the floor. Paper towels are in the closet. Or you could even say, here's a paper towel. Finish. And they look at you like you're nuts. Say, what kind of class have you been going to? And they take off for the playroom. Right? Now which mode do we shift into? Straight into love and logic. We spoke all the right words, we used nice language, and nothing happened. So guess who's not panicked in the kitchen? Mom or Dad. I have oranges on my floor, but I'm not panicked. And I'm also guaranteed that I am not going to be the one to clean this up. Now, as long as you can manage a few minutes with oranges on the floor, some spills need to be cleaned up right away. Most can probably last for a few minutes because it'll only be a few minutes until your child wants something else to eat. The beautiful way that God created the world, most children get hungry. They like snacks, they like drinks. And guess what happens when you have a drink and it spills and you haven't cleaned it up yet? Very straightforward. I'd love to give you whatever it is that you've asked as soon as mess on the kitchen floor is cleaned up. And you go back to whatever you're doing, and before long, the mess will be cleaned up. There was no yelling, there's no screaming, there's no demanding, it's just a matter of when it happens. Wow. What do you think we should do about that? I know there are paper towels in the drawer. Eventually, and I've seen this happen, they will right away, as long as you're not worked up about a spill. Because, by the way, if you don't know yet, let me just tell you something. A 3-year-old spill things. I know, it's news. It happens. You really think that they're going to be perfect and hold their cups really well, and they get distracted. Yeah, it's true.
I was going to say, so my daughter's going to eventually stop being all excited about helping clean up.
Yeah, probably. Okay. But it's fine. I mean, you're doing a great job that you tell me. You know, that's wonderful. Totally fine. She will probably outgrow that, and you'll come back to this. But that's fine. If she doesn't, that's also fine. If she, there'll be other issues where you'll be able to implement that. But it's a very straightforward technique of just pointing out what needs to be done. Oh, there's orange juice on the floor. As long as, again, the key thing is when they spill, that you don't get crazed about it, because children spill. I want you to watch your child's face the next time they spill milk at the table. Or they bang over their cereal bowl and there's like just a mess everywhere. Watch their face, because what they're used to, or probably not your children, but my children used to, was some tirade coming from the big bad adult of, sounds something like that to them, about how frustrated we are, they have to clean their mess, and you see on their face the terror, like, I'm in big trouble now. 3-year-olds spill milk. They knock over bowls. They drop their pizza on the floor. They do all of that. And the greatest gift we can give them is, hey, no problem. How should we handle that? And they'll figure it out, and they'll take care of it. It's not a big deal, and they're growing, and that's what happens. And in a total state of calm, they themselves will take care. And if they don't, no problem, because they'll want something else really soon. And then it'll be totally fine. I'd love to, just as soon as that's done. And then, depending on how strict the love and logic parent you decide to be, whatever the situation warrants, it can either be, you know, once you spill the orange juice, let's say they clean it up fairly quickly right away afterwards. Then you have the option of saying, depending on what, if it was a simple spill, I wouldn't use this, but sometimes it's a little bit worse. I mean, it's like, that's it, I only give out one cup of orange juice, you know, for breakfast. If you told them 1,000 times to be more careful, but that's, you know, I would give them a second cup unless it was something where they really needed for whatever reason, like that was it, so to give them another chance. That's most of the situations. But that's actually getting into the, let me use this example and go, let's go down to the case studies, letter B. Let's just play out this whole scenario. Let me just finish up. I just did it right now, but let's just, let's start it from the top. You give your kid a cup of orange juice. Let's say it's a 3 to 4 year old and they have it right at the edge of the table, right there. And you as a parent know that 99% of the times when you see a cup right there, it's going to end up, now you know that already. You see it happening. You say as a parent, right, you want to move it? Right? I don't want to move it because I have a significant learning opportunity for my child. What do I say to my child?
Please move the cup.
Okay, we could do that. Please move the cup. Why am I not the biggest fan of that? I just told my child what to do. I'd rather not direct him. What can I say to really accomplish the same thing? Right? One thing, so going through the favorite managers' cartoons, one would just be a word saying, there's a cup at the edge of the table, which is slightly different, but it actually sounds very different to a child when you say, please move the cup, a gut reaction of every human being when someone says to them, please do this is?
No.
So when you said it that way, you really said it really nicely and sweet. Say, please move the cup, sweetheart. The gut reaction of a healthy child is, no, it's doing just fine. Right? That would be my reaction. If you told me to move my cup, I would say, well, you move my cup. My cup is just fine where it is. Thank you very much. So, but I want to warn my child because the cup's at the other, and I know that 99% of the time, nothing's going to happen. So I could either just say cup, or I could say, I see a cup at the edge of the table. Something along those lines, which is what I would say. I see the cups at the edge of the table. The child will look, and probably about 96% of the time do what? Nothing. I would think. Most of the time, the child got it, and they'll do nothing. Some of the times, because there's been no confrontation, because all you said was, I see a cup at the edge of the table, sometimes they'll actually move it. Most of the times, they probably won't, which will then kick us right into stage two, which is what happens is then it gets knocked over. Now, your response is not... I told you to come on the edge of the table. Worst thing in the world, you don't have to do that. They got it. They just learned a lesson. Unless you clean it up. This is just finishing up what we started on. If you clean up their mess, then we really accomplished nothing here. Because you pointed out very nicely the cups at the edge of the table, and they said, I know, you're going to be cleaning up my spill in 3 minutes. What do you want me to do about it? So, given the instruction, they knock it off, and then they're in charge of cleaning it up, which is a simple, wow. Oh, I hate when that happens. And I would have often have said, whenever I leave the cup at the edge of the table, it also always spills over, and then I have to clean it up. That's so frustrating. There are towels over there. Totally calm. You will see they will clean it up themselves. And if they don't, then it's just into the love and logic. That's just how that goes. Let me give another example that is right along this line. Getting dressed in the morning. One of my favorites. I'm going to use an example that someone actually spoke to me about this week. Let's just go through this as well. Getting dressed in the morning. This will be a scenario in which you go through everything just fine. In 2 minutes, we're going to be getting dressed. In 1 minute, we're going to be dressed. Take a minute, we're going to be getting dressed. And you pick at their clothing. Let's say they're a child that's quasi able to do it themselves and quasi not able to do it themselves. And they say something along the lines, you pick up the clothes and say, you want to get dressed yourself this morning, would you like me to help you? They're at that stage, you give them a choice, and they say something along the lines of, you get me dressed, but they say it in a way that you weren't, not appropriate, in terms of how they spoke with you. And your response to that right away is? That's a funny way to ask. They say, can you please help me? And you say, sure. So you get down, you start taking off their pajamas, And as soon as you begin to get them into their clothing, they start doing their resistance, which in any of your, whatever that looks like. It could be running around the room, it could be kicking, it could be whatever. You know your children better than me, whatever the resistance is. What's your response as you've now gotten them to ask you correctly? You, absolutely, I have time to do so. You get down and they resist. Your response is? Okay. How would you say, I see you're choosing to get yourself? There are two ways of doing that. One is exactly as Mindy said, which would be to say that. I see you're choosing to get yourself dressed. I would prefer, personally, that's fine. I don't say anything. I drop their clothes and walk out of the room. Done. No problem. I'm here to help you. You don't want to get dressed right now? No problem. I got other things to do. I'm going to work on the lunches. And as I walk out the room, I almost always hear, wait. I say, are you ready to get dressed now? And they say, yeah, I'm ready. I say, great. There's no lecture. It's just a matter of, you're not ready now. That's fine. I'm not going to fight you. I leave the clothing here. I'm out. When you're ready, we'll try again. You're ready now? I'm happy to go. Yeah.
I did that this morning. Yeah. I was in this class.
Yeah.
And my son just ran around the house naked for like a very long time.
Excellent.
And I ignored him.
Okay.
And he went about like a few months.
Okay.
And he just kept saying, "Why am I not dressed?" And I was like, "I see that." And I said, "I already tried to get dressed twice."
Perfect.
And I said, "So when you're ready, the dress." And then he just like continues to just run around naked. And it was like the most funniest thing in the entire world. That I wasn't
totally fine. Yeah. Now, play it out. Now what happened?
And when he finally saw me getting dressed, he said, "Hey, what about me? I want to get dressed." So I said, "Okay, your clothes are in the living room." Because that was where he. And he did not want to go get them himself. So I honestly don't even remember, but I know I didn't go get the clothes. So I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I just ignored him.
Perfect.
And he did eventually get dressed for school, but I don't know how. I don't remember.
Well, I'm assuming it was successful, so I'm going to take credit for that. It sounds good. But no, playing that scenario out, and this is how you play it out. Is it a problem for your child to run around the house naked for you?
I have all the blind clothes.
Okay, so that's always the question. So in other words, that's exactly what they're going to play out. Is this a problem for you or not? So let's say it would have been a problem for you. So then it would be a matter of, if you don't want to be dressed right now, you can be in your room or the bathroom. That's where it's okay to be without clothing. If you want to be outside, you have to be dressed. So give him a choice like that. But if it was not a problem for you to run around the house naked, okay, just say, let him run around the house naked. When he says, what about me? He says, whenever you're ready, I'm happy to get you dressed. And if it'd be time to leave, and you give him the warning, say, okay, I'm just letting you know, we're leaving in 5 minutes. Not with a lecture of, I'm telling you, you know, we're leaving in a few minutes. Whenever you're ready, to just let me know. And if he's not, then there'd be a matter of whether or not you actually can take him out. Like, by that age already, he doesn't want that. And he'll probably on his own say, okay, I'm ready now. And there's just no battle. As long as there was no...
At that point, when he's ready, you still have him get his own clothing.
So then again, that all is based on, I don't have like steadfast rules of, if I ask you once, I'm not going to... Then it's a matter of, the goal is to get him dressed without a fight. If it means you going to the living room to get the clothing, but he's not resistant when you get him dressed, again, it's... That's the thing, there are no... And it's like, if we are pure love and logic and we were stringent about it, we would say, he has to do it himself, you tried once. You got to be a parent, you got to be a human. So, if like going to the room, to me, big deal. If that was part of the battle, you know, where it was, so then let him do it. But I don't make yourself crazy about those things. Now, the main thing is, he was resistant, so you said, great, I'm out of here. And when he says, what about me? When you're ready, I'll be happy to help you. You tell me when you're ready. And that works. And the fact that you don't remember what happened to me is a good thing. That means it wasn't like a traumatic experience. He just got dressed.
Yeah.
I mean,
if we're going younger,
yeah,
the child would be perfectly happy to be naked all day long.
So is that a problem for you?
Yeah. I mean, like it's like 40 degrees.
So is that, so in other words, so that...
Turn the heat up.
Leaving the house and bringing her to daycare. She would prefer to be naked.
It's Georgia.
So
we have to get going, and she's not done. 8:50. So at that point.
Yeah, so here's where... This is where the reality is, it gets always difficult, and it's always simple in terms of, like, when you hit that point in which you need to leave, and she's just absolutely refusing to get dressed. So the question would be, if it's, again, I'm going to throw out suggestions, and I don't have all the answers for these. Like, each case is different in terms of figuring out, like, where is the line where she will not, it won't work. In other words, will she be accepted into daycare if she's not dressed? Like, will they take her not dressed? So, like, there's a certain point where if you got her there, they would say, this is not acceptable. I imagine, right? Daycare's not going to take her without any clothing. And I assume you could for sure talk to the teacher beforehand and say, don't take her without any clothing. That probably is not a big deal. So let's just...
She doesn't want to go to daycare. She doesn't like it.
Send him to that
Jane. She doesn't like going. So this is part of her resistance. She doesn't want to go. Okay, so then it's really a different issue. In other words, then it's not really a matter of getting her dressed. It's that she doesn't want to go where you're taking her. And she's finding this as like, well, you can't take me if I'm not dressed. So I'm not going to go. I'm not going to get dressed. That's a different issue. Well, I'm happy to try to figure something out, but I think that's beyond just where some basic tools and stuff we're looking at. Do you have a question?
No, I was just kind of going on. You have to have a lot of patience, and kind of back to what you were saying about behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know if they would kind of going on the same lines. Of,
yeah.
If you keep doing that, they're going to just always know. Well. I'm just not going to get dressed until I want to get dressed.
Now, again, so let's go back to what we spoke of last week. Can you or can you not control a child getting dressed? You can. Once a child gets to a pretty young age, you cannot control it, which means that, yeah, that's right. So what you can control are the circumstances around it, which are much more along the lines of breakfast is served to children who are dressed. That's pretty easy to control. So you just, and that's always where these are principles and in your own homes and your own lives need to adapt in the sense of, okay, I can't force you to get dressed, but I can manipulate my own home that in my house, breakfast is served to children who are dressed because there's too much time in the morning. If you eat breakfast, there are lots of easy reasons where it makes sense to do stuff like that. So it's just always being, again, this doesn't make parenting easy because you always still have to be working on, you know, what makes sense? What do I do with a child who won't get dressed? Where does the consequence fit?
Right, to fit that situation. And I've also taken one of my kids to school in their pajamas. You know, if you don't want to get dressed, okay.
Right.
You got to go.
Right, and you pack along
and
a little bag.
You're embarrassed, right.
Exactly, and I was like, most kids, that's what will happen to. And then they'll want to get dressed, and they're fine. It doesn't matter to me as a parent if my child gets dressed in my house or in my car. The point is, I can't control them. And they're going to get dressed in the car. So if they like getting dressed in the car, that works for them, unless it doesn't work for me, but that's not a battle. I'm not willing to fight that battle. Let them get dressed, right? And you know, I have like my kids with coats. Same story. I have a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old trying to get coats on them. It's freezing outside. Policy in my house is, when it's cold, you must bring your coat to school. You don't have to wear it, because I am not fighting with a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old to get in a coat, because I lose that battle every morning. Correct. So, but they have it, right? Every morning they have it, right? My preschool director will attest to the fact that my children come in without it, because I'm not fighting that. And you know what? In the 30 seconds that they're outside, they must bring their coat. And you know, this morning, what do they say when I say you need to put it? What do they say? I'm not cold. So I can say to them, no, you are cold. So I'm not going to engage that battle of you are cold, I'm not cold. I could say it's cold outside. Now, I personally, if you remember my story about my own ears and fingers, I'm not going to tell somebody when it is or is not cold outside for them. And I knew that. So they, it's cold. I think it's cold outside. You need to bring your coat. And you can. I'm not going to force you to wear it. And they opened the door. And this week, because it was cold outside, they both said, it was cold outside. I put on my coat. And they put on their coat. And sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And it doesn't, like, when they're outside for more than a few minutes, like on the walk home from shul and do the same thing, guess what they did? They put on the coat because it's cold outside. So they haven't got, you know, if it's 20 degrees and we live to somewhere else, and then, okay, then it'd be a different battle. But they go from the house to the car, from the car to the school, they're outside for all of 30 seconds of it. Right? Let them go. Let them, you know, they're doing it. I got other battles to fight. Yeah.
Having like jelly legs in the parking lot while you're holding.
No.
When they just pretend like they're sick.
Drop,
like, they just,
like, oh yeah.
Like, and, like, and then you're holding a baby, or my wife's like shopping.
Yeah.
And she's holding a baby, and they're in a parking lot. So, like,
yes.
It's not safe.
Park me to pick her up.
So what do you do at that point? Like, you can't play games.
So I'll tell you what happens with that. This is how love and logic would tell you to do it. It's hard to manipulate, but if you have an advance, you figure it out. This is how you would handle that situation. figure out, just get her into the car however you can at that moment. You just, whatever needs to take, you get into the car, you get home. Then you create a scenario in which you manipulate it, because in a situation like that, you have to create a consequence and you have to create that situation. So usually what you try to create is, as soon as you get home and as soon as the two of you are together, you create a situation and you'd say, okay, I'm going out for ice cream, something along those lines. And your daughter says, I want to come, something along those lines. And you say something along the lines of, oh, I want to take you so badly. I love going to ice cream with you. But last time we were in the parking lot, you just fell right on the floor and I couldn't move you and it wasn't safe. I'm really afraid of taking you for ice cream, because if you just do that again, I'm not going to be able to manage it. And she's going to say something along the lines of, I won't. And you're going to say something along the lines of, I know, next time we go out together, I'm sure you won't. And you leave. That's if you would listen to a loved one, they would say that's exact. You right there that day, you would create something along those lines in which you have him home, so you know that you can do it. And she says to herself, "Well, that didn't work out very well for me at all." And then you come home with ice cream, and it's amazing, and you feel so bad that you didn't get any. Or you could just go out for whatever it is. That really is where you're creating, where she did a certain behavior, and the result of that is, I'm not comfortable taking you with me, because if you do that, I can't. And you say to her, listen, when that happened, you saw, I can't deal with the baby, and when you're on the floor like that, I'm too nervous. I really wish, and again, if it's like, if it's as vengeful, it won't work. But if it's like, I know, I love taking you, I'm sure next time I'll be able to, and just get out of the house. That is magical. But you need to be able to manipulate that, and you need to create the situation. That's a little bit of the manipulation of a love and logic technique. Usually you don't have to, consequences happen much more naturally, but those kinds of situations, I agree with you, like, you're in this situation, you're stuck. You just, what are you going to do there? You can't, there's no consequence, you can't leave her there. Right? You can't say, like, I'm leaving, she's in the middle of the street. Right? So you have to deal with it, and then it has to be the consequences later. And this is, I'm glad you brought up that example, because this happens lots of times where at the time there's nothing you can do, but the consequence is, well, last time we did X, Y, or Z, last time we were at a friend's house and I told you it was time to go, it took 20 minutes to get out of the house, so we're not going to be able to do that the next time they ask for it, but I'm sure the next time, and then that consequence has to come out if he doesn't cheat or doesn't go, and then the next day you give him another opportunity. So it has to be where they actually suffer the consequence. And then you give them the opportunity fairly soon afterwards. You know, I have said many times that when it comes to, like, parking lots and things that are dangerous, I want my children to cry. Like, when I see them about to run into a street and I'll yell, I actually want them to cry. Because, no, this is life and death. And I want them to know that it's serious. And if they start crying because they got yelled at when they ran into the street, I am happy. Because I want them to remember that. I don't want them to be crying any other time when I speak with them. I'm not interested in that. That means I've lost it if they're crying. But if they run into a street and I say, you never run into a street, and they look at me like panic stricken, then I don't mind at all. Because that's serious. I'm not always going to be with them. And I want them to remember that the one time that Daddy yelled at them, and it wasn't yelling, it was just, you never run, was street. I don't mind at all. So if in your mind telling them some horror story is equivalent to that, so that's fine. So if that's what you feel you need, that's, you know, I mean, I, whatever. I personally have the opinion that a child should know that there's a difference between when I say, like, you may not go to your friend's house and you may not run into the street. I wanted to know, I use the same words, but there's a difference. And so my tone says that, and that tone is reserved for dangerous issues, and I hope have done a good job that they recognize, like, when they hear that from me, like, oh, that's serious. But if that, you know, that works for you, I don't know how to answer that question. Let's just go through a couple of other stuff. Coming out of bed. Anyone ever have any problem with children coming out of bed at night? Yeah, so this is a classic. So there are two age brackets in which you have this issue of coming out of bed. This is just my experience. You have the younger age bracket of a child coming out of bed, and you have the older age bracket of a child, meaning older, meaning 5, 6, 7, and under 5, 6, 7. Under 5, 6, or 7, so it would be a very simple technique of you put them into bed, and then they come out. And being willing to repeat over and over and over again as much as possible, simply without engaging them. Child comes out, picking them back up, it's bedtime, and you put them back in. No words, no speeches, no anything, it's just, you need to be in here, and you're back in. And then they're going to probably come back out again.
2 minutes.
2 minutes what?
That's what they're requesting, because I always say to them.
Right, and you say, no, we had 2 minutes already, and back in bed. That process, the first night or two, for younger kids, might actually repeat itself 5, 6, 7, 8 times. Some people have told me it's lasted an hour or two. If it lasts more than an hour or two consistently, as I spoke, it could be your child's actually not ready for bed. I know that sounds really strange, because we are convinced that just because our child was ready for bed at 6:30 when they were like 18 months old, that they should be ready for bed at 6:30 when they're 20 months old and 28 months old and 36 months old. And believe it or not, children actually progress, and especially if they're napping in the day, if it lasts for like literally an hour or two, they might actually not be tired. It's a possibility. I know we can't stand that thought because we need quiet in the house, but it's true. Don't let them nap during the day.
How do you explain that to an older child that says that's not fair?
What I'm saying is, I know it's not fair. She's not tired. I know you feel it's not fair.
It's like special attention. Yeah. There's already special attention issues.
Yeah, so in my house, for an older child, what I would say, like, why is she going to stay? I would say, because I love her so much. Right? And then she would say, but then why don't I get to stay up later? See, because I love you so much. That, and we've had that conversation, and they laugh, and they get frustrated, but I don't have an answer to those. Can you explain to a six-year-old that their three-year-old sibling napped during the day, and that's why they're staying up, and that's not going to work. So that's the kind of conversation where it's not going to go anywhere. An older child, if a six-year-old comes out, and this one I learned from experience, this was a great one. I learned this when my eldest daughter started babysitting. So the kids with the younger boys would have their bedtimes, and then they would give her a hard time. They would not go to bed when it was time. They would go in, they would come out, and then what would happen is she hadn't taken my parenting classes yet, so she didn't know any of these techniques. So what she would do is she would revert back to just yelling and screaming and dragging and kicking, and it was a disaster, and it was really not the way that we were hoping that our bedtime routine would work when we had left the house, and we hadn't really trained her. So what we came up with, and it's a really, really great thing, and I suggest it to all of you as your children get above 5, 6, 7, into that age, and you have either a babysitter or an older sibling, is we simply tell the children before we leave as follows. We say, bedtime is at 7:45. I'm not asking the babysitter to put you to bed. I'm asking her to remind you it's 7:45, and if you'd like to put to bed, she'll help you. And then she's just going to tell us what time you got into bed. That's all we're asking of her. And if it's 8 o'clock, so great, you're up 15 minutes later, then tomorrow night we'll take that 15 minutes from tomorrow night's routine when we're home and we can manage that. And that worked beautifully. My daughter was only in charge, a little piece of paper. Just tell us, and we said to the boys, she's just going to write down what time you got into bed. Don't worry about anything else. She's just going to look at the clock whenever you get in. She's going to tell you what time is bedtime, and then she's just going to see. And she was like relieved of the burden. It's not your babysitter's problem. It's not your elder child's problem. Whose problem is the fact they're not getting into bed? The child's problem. So they know that, like, oh, someone's watching, and who's going to suffer the consequences the next night? They do. They spend an extra 5 minutes, no problem. Bedtime tomorrow night is 7:40 because we use those extra 5 minutes, which, by the way, it's the same tool when a child, let's say you find a child sneaking dessert or taking an extra portion or stuff like that, which is regular children's stuff and you're not really sure how to handle it. No problem. When it becomes dessert time and everybody else gets, and it's, right, I'm so sorry, you already had. This isn't a punishment. It's, you already had your dessert. Usually we eat dessert after dinner. You decided to have it before dinner. And it's end of discussion. It's not a, no strong, just a very simple, it's just these consequences constantly playing themselves out. Questions, comments?
Can we go back to the less than 5 being put in bed and they come back out?
Yeah.
Just for an hour.
I just keep doing that. You're teaching, they're testing that if they come out, they can stay out. That's what they want. But it's time to be in bed, assuming that it's actually their bedtime and they're tired and they should be in bed.
Right, they're overtired, it's there, they should be sleeping.
Right. Can you force a child to stay in bed?
No.
Right. So that's always the first question we ask. Can I force the behavior that I wish? The answer is no. I mean, you can sort of sit there and hold the child down. And I tried that once when I got really frustrated, but it really doesn't work well.
They're screaming, they're flailing.
Yeah, it's just a I didn't like that. I tried. It didn't work. They didn't fall asleep either. It didn't. It wasn't such a good thing. Okay, that's one option. Your other option is to lock them in their room. Right? Anyone ever try that? How does that work? Right? Really not good, because what do you normally get when you do that? Like, bam, bam, bam. It doesn't work so well. So you could stand guard at the door, and you could, as they come out, you could catch them. That's an option. How does that work? That's right. So at the end of the day, if my I can't keep my child in. So an older child understands the consequence that when they come out now, they're going to pay for it tomorrow. They get that, and they don't like it. Yeah, so an older child who gets really the concept of the bedtime. Younger children, like under four, they don't really get that concept, even five. My five-year-old wouldn't, my daughter just turned five, wouldn't at all understand the concept of bedtime. She doesn't get the clock yet. My 6 and 7-year-olds, they're like into, you know, my bedtime's about 7:45, they're into that. But a child who can't tell time yet, so it doesn't work. So what do you have on such a child? You can't physically keep them in their bed. So all you can do is you could teach them that coming out will actually accomplish nothing. Because what do they want? They want to be out. But they can't be. But they can't understand that. So it's a matter of they come out and they get put back in. Calmly, without engaging them other than it's bedtime. They're learning, they're testing you. Like, how many times do I need to come out until daddy says, just forget it? And if you allow that, then what have you taught them? It will work. There's a point at which I will win and be able to stay up as late as I want. So why would they ever stop if it works? So there are two options. Let me finish. So I have on some occasions, like that normally works for me. It works. I go back in and eventually there's an end to it. On some occasions, we have just given up. But it's like towards the beginning, like we're just not going to be there, and we just ignore them. They're in the house, and we just totally ignore them. But that's the exception in which they get nothing, they can't play with anything, they just sit there, and eventually they just fall asleep on the couch or they go into their bed. But even then, there's almost always a consequence that we'll come up with while we're sitting there, and they're like just hanging out in the playroom, and will be something along the lines, you know, come with some consequence about it. That's where I don't have anything on top of my head of. This is where we'll be sitting there, and the child's like sitting there playing, thinking he's won. And we're like thinking, like, okay, what makes sense, given that we have to expend so much energy? And you'll come up with something, and it usually, you know, will help stimulate the child to want to get back into bed. But I have found most of the time, just consistency over a night or two really works. And I found it's just my experience. Some of your children might be more persistent than mine, and then I can't help you. But that's doesn't make sense. Yeah.
How do you create confidence when your son repeatedly goes about his business to wake your daughter either during nap time or
bedtime?
And you're sitting there and you want to say, like, you keep making your sister be 3 years old. So, like, he doesn't really care. He kind of like smiles like it's fun.
Right.
He's having this great time. But yet, you know, she's on a schedule and you're trying to keep her on a schedule and keep her happy.
Excellent. So that's a good one. You have to figure out, like, are they in the same room?
The next door to each other.
He likes it in his room, I imagine. So there would be some type of consequence. Now, this is where, again, I don't know the layout of your house exactly, but let's say he doesn't like sleeping in
the car.
Or the basement. You may not have a basement. In other words, like in my house, I have a basement, so you just have to adapt this. It would be a matter of when it becomes bedtime, without fanfare or punishment, it would just be, okay, we're going to go to bed in the basement. And say, I know, but when you're upstairs, you wake up your sister, and that doesn't work for her. So we're gonna sleep down here tonight. I'll stay down here for you for a little bit until you fall asleep. Because in other words, I'm not going to torture the child being in a place where he's afraid. But he wants to be in his room. That's where the good stuff is. And you're going to sleep in the basement. I'll stay with you, but you can't be upstairs because it wakes up your sister. So you need to adapt that and figure out a way where he can go to sleep. And if it's a car, you know, if that works for you. In other words, again, it's a matter of, does that work for you? So I mean, it's like find something. I'm telling you, I would be shocked if you needed to do it more than once, more than twice. in which he said, okay, it's bedtime, and you literally took his blanket and a book, and you went out to the car, and you turned on the car. I'm serious. You're investing $15 in gas. You're going to turn the car, and you're going to say, I'll stay out here with you, but we're going to sleep here tonight because when you're in your room, I'm making up something, but like, I don't think it would last more than once or twice, but it's something along those lines of figuring out, or it's a matter of moving her, something that, again, depends on later, you move her into your room, which might be a big treat, and you go, why is she getting there? Well, because when she's next to you, you're making so much noise, so we need a place for her. It's just a matter of, you have to figure out your house, what you're comfortable with, what you're not comfortable with, in terms of, it won't be more than a night or two. You could do that. All those things work. Just do something that defects won't get upset about. But as long as it's something reasonable, I mean it very seriously, where you come up with a concept that says, I really would like for you to go to sleep in your room, but what happens when you're there is you like to play loudly, and don't say it in a way of like, not in a way of like, you wake up your sister. You like to be loud, and it wakes up your sister, so we just thought it'd be, Mommy and I thought it'd be better for you to go to sleep over here. Oh, I want to sleep over here. I say, I know. Tomorrow night we're going to try to be quiet. Oh, try it! Now that might be the kind of thing where you say, well, try right now. Okay, you want to try? We could try. In other words, sometimes you actually want them to live the consequence once. Something like this. If he said, as you're walking out to the car, you know, with a blanket, and you got yourself a book, and he says, I'll be quiet. You say, really? You think you could be quiet? He says, yeah. So, all right, let's try. I would be totally fine with, okay, let's give it a shot. And you never get it to the car, and you see if it works. And if he wakes her up, then you go back to he just needs to see that you're, like, serious, and it's something that, again, you're comfortable with, and that going to the car might be. But anything else? I know it's getting late. I want to keep you guys. I'm, like, a fan of this stuff. We can go on forever, but I know that you guys have to get home and to your children.